From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. He's the Soviet journalist with the New York accent. Vladimir Posner has been a frequent guest on Nightline and Donahue, defending his country's policies. On today's Fresh Air, Posner tells us why his family moved from New York to the Soviet Union. We discuss Soviet journalism during perestroika and bring up the question of Posner's own credibility. Also, we meet rock musician and producer Dave Edmonds and find out how a kid from Wales got turned on to American rockabilly. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album from The Smithereens. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Revenge, starring Kevin Costner and Anthony Quinn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. President Bush is hailing the results of anti-drug summit in Cartagena with the leaders of Colombia, Bolivia, and Peru. He said their agreement on a coordinated attack on drug trafficking is unprecedented.
In signing the document, we've committed ourselves to the first common, comprehensive international drug control strategy. We, in fact, created the first anti-drug cartel.
A joint communique addresses the issues of illegal drug supply and demand and confronts questions of how the Andean economies would be affected by ending cocaine production. But President Bush said their commitment to choking off coca crops should not depend on U.S. moves to ease trade restrictions on flowers, coffee, and other legal export products.
What we did on the flowers is explain the procedures at the Commerce Department and say that we would try to help in negotiating that. But the point is, it shouldn't be linked to whether people, you know, condone the growing of a crop that is illegal.
The president is flying back to Washington late tonight. During the one-day meeting, leftist guerrillas reportedly kidnapped an American priest in the city of Cali. He's the third U.S. citizen to disappear in Colombia this week. The pro-Cuban guerrillas also issued a statement warning that they now consider all U.S. interests in Colombia to be military targets. Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry faces new charges. A federal grand jury today indicted Barry on 5 counts of illegal drug possession and 3 felony counts of perjury. Barry, arrested last month for allegedly smoking crack cocaine, is under treatment at a substance abuse clinic in Florida. The United Mine Workers Union announced today it will put a tentative contract with the Pittston Company to a vote on Monday. If the UMW rank and file approve the proposed settlement, the roughly 1,700 striking coal miners could be back to work late next week. Susan Loeffler reports.
UMW President Richard Trumka said the vote will take place despite the fact that more than $64 million in fines are still outstanding against the union. Until today, the UMW had made the vote contingent on a waiver of the penalties. In a written statement, Trumka said, "Our members fought long and hard to secure the tentative agreement, and it's their right to see it and to vote on it." He didn't say why the UMW had changed its position on the fines or how it planned to deal with the debt. On Monday, a Virginia judge refused to waive the penalties and gave the union 10 days to argue its case. Union officials now say members will vote on the tentative contract on Monday. For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Loeffler in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 25 points to close at 2649.55. Advances led declines 9 to 5 in active trading of 174 million shares. This is NPR News. In Pretoria, thousands of white conservatives staged a protest march today to demand the resignation of South African President F.W. de Klerk, this in the wake of the release of black nationalist leader Nelson Mandela. The African National Congress's elder statesman met at his Soweto home today with U.S. civil rights leader Jesse Jackson. Today in Chicago, Mayor Richard Daley proposed a site for the city's third major airport. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
Chicago is already served by 2 major airports, including O'Hare International Airport, one of the busiest in the world. The third airport would be located on a site larger than O'Hare, on Chicago's southeast side. That area, bordering northern Indiana, was once dominated by steel mills and other heavy industry. Mayor Daley said today that the new facility would bring new jobs to communities in decline and would divert congestion and noise from Chicago's other 2 airports. but the mayor and his advisors cautioned that today's proposal is only a concept that's subject to change and that's likely to take the next 30 years to develop. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
A new survey says half of all Americans don't think the Social Security system will have the money to pay them when they retire. This despite the growing surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund. The Gallup Organization poll found younger adults were most pessimistic about Social Security, while those closer to retirement age were more likely to expect benefits. The Gallup survey was conducted in December before congressional Democrats proposed cutting Social Security payroll taxes to prevent the trust fund surplus from being used to hide the size of the federal deficit. A Social Security spokesman said that at the end of 1989, the trust fund surplus totaled about $168 billion, enough for about 9 months of benefits. Recapping stocks, the Dow Industrials rose more than 25 points today to close at 2649.55. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. He's been called Moscow's mouthpiece, but he's also been described as refreshing because he confronts American stereotypes about life in the Soviet Union. You've seen my guest, Vladimir Posner, on Nightline and Donahue, explaining, usually defending, Soviet policies. Posner is a Soviet journalist who's a political commentator and hosts a Soviet TV show on current issues. But until a few years ago, Posner was better known outside his country than in it. His commentary in the Soviet Union was limited to English-speaking broadcasts, and his early articles were published in the English-language magazine Soviet Life. Posner sounds like he grew up in New York, because he did. His Russian-born father emigrated to France in 1922, where he married. The family left for New York during World War II and moved to the Soviet Union in the early 50s. I told Posner it's easy to think of him as the Soviet ambassador to American TV talk shows, but he didn't go for that description at all.
To be an ambassador, you have to represent your country, and that's something I've never done. It is true that I have appeared on American television perhaps more than most of my citizen friends, but in fact, I don't represent the government or the country. Simply, I guess it's just the fact that I do speak English, that I was one of the first to appear, and so that's the impression that's been created.
Do you think of yourself as representing a new image for the Soviet Union on American television?
Well, not really. I first appeared on American television at the very end of 1979. I think it was on Nightline, and it was because of a journalist who's now working for NPR, incidentally, Annie Garrels, who was at that time the ABC bureau chief in Moscow, who thought it would be good to have a Soviet journalist talking about things Soviet, not just American journalists talking about what was happening in the Soviet Union. So that perhaps was a novelty in itself, and the fact that I speak English without a Russian accent, and again, that was new. But I don't think that it was a novelty in any other sense. Simply because before me, there weren't really many Soviets on American television at all, so there was nothing to compare with.
Do you think, though, that the Soviets who were on American television misunderstood American media and didn't always use it very well?
I guess you might have a point there, although I don't think they cared. I think they cared much more about what people in the Soviet Union would think about what they'd said. They knew, just as I knew, that they were being watched by Soviet officials in the embassy, that they were being watched by Soviet officials working at the UN in New York City, and that there would be reports filed on how they'd done. And they were much more worried and much more concerned about what the Soviets would have to say than what about what Americans would think. So that they were going to, I would say, toe the line no matter what, and perhaps look like very unpleasant Russian villains. They couldn't care less as long as they got good marks. And I think perhaps that was the greatest difference between that type of Soviet journalist and myself. And I think that was probably noticed.
You said that as a journalist that you don't consider yourself in any way representing the government or a spokesperson of the government, that you're there as an independent person speaking your views. I think some people are skeptical of that in the sense that they think perhaps you wouldn't be allowed to practice journalism if you weren't carrying out, to some extent, the views of the party.
I understand perfectly why they might believe that. And I think that up until the time when Gorbachev became general secretary, there would be reason to think that if you as a journalist did not, let us say, respect a certain framework, you would not be able to do your work. And that's true. And I did respect that framework. But there's a difference between being that and a spokesman, a mouthpiece. I never was a mouthpiece. I never did come out as a spokesman for the government. Now, if people were to ask me, but did you ever in any of these interviews critical, were you ever critical about your government? Did you ever criticize the party? I would have to say that no, I did not. I did disagree on certain things. But when I did that, there were people in this country who said, well, if he's doing it, then he had to have permission to do it. He wouldn't risk doing it without that permission. And there they were wrong. But they were prisoners of, and many of them still are, I'd have to say, prisoners of their own prejudice, of their own stereotypes that have been built up as a result of U.S. media. This is what a Russian is supposed to do. This is how a Russian looks. This is how a Russian speaks. And if you don't conform to that, then something's wrong.
Vladimir Posner is my guest, and he's a Soviet journalist and political observer. He's also a frequent guest on U.S. shows such as Nightline and Donahue. He's written a new autobiography called Parting with Illusions. In your new book, you write that part of the reason for your effectiveness on American television was your willingness to admit to certain shortcomings in the Soviet Union. But did you have to be very choosy about which shortcomings you'd admit to?
Of course I did. I had to be careful, knowing that if I went too far, I would probably lose my job, which nearly happened to me once when I was critical of Soviet involvement in Afghanistan. That was back in 1981. But I'd like to stress that what I had to do is true of any journalist. I mean, imagine, if you will, an American journalist working, let us say, for ABC or for CBS or for NBC, going on Soviet television during those years when we were in a confrontational stance and being critical of America. I'm sure that he would or she would be in trouble with their own network. People know these things, and I definitely had to be careful as well.
Do you think the Cold War is over?
Yes, I do. I think it's over for good. I don't see any possibility of a revival of the Cold War. That's finished.
Why do you feel so certain of that?
Because the conditions that made the Cold War possible are gone and cannot be revived. There are no longer two blocks in Europe, and there's no way that you can have them again. The confrontational stance between the U.S. and the USSR is no longer the same, nor can it be, because of what's happened in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union. It is just not to happen again, that's all. There's no way. And I think that I'm not saying that there's no danger of confrontation as such, and that there could not be, at least theoretically, a military confrontation. But the Cold War as a political instrument is no longer viable.
I'm wondering what your reaction and the mood of your friends is about the reunification of Germany.
I think you have to distinguish between my reaction, a man of my age, I'm 56, and I have my prejudice, and I'll call it that, my prejudice about Germany, East and West. But there are other people who are younger, and there are much more of them, thankfully, who don't have that prejudice. And I think, very strongly feel, that prejudice or no, the people of Germany have the right to decide whether or not they want to reunite. And I think it's normal for a country that was together and it was split by something as tragic as the war, to come back together again. And I think most Soviets would share that view. And I don't think that there's as much apprehension about the danger of a united Germany as some seem to make us believe. Because, again, the situation is not the same. In the nuclear era, Germany, a united Germany, does not represent the kind of threat it did in the 1940s.
Well, there are discussions now about whether a reunified Germany should be a neutral country or a NATO ally. Do you think that the Soviet Union would allow Germany, if reunited, to become a NATO ally?
That's a very serious question, and I think you have to, there's a legitimate consideration there of security, and that is the Soviet position, indeed, that Germany should be neutral, while the Western position is that Germany should remain a NATO ally. Personally, my view is that I would prefer to see a neutral Germany, but I don't think that the condition of neutrality is going to be the final word. I believe the Germanys will unite no matter what. It will happen. I think that perhaps we should look forward to the time when there will not be a NATO or a Warsaw Pact organization. I don't think we need that anymore. We do need a small contingent, perhaps for American security and for Soviet security it might make sense, considering the danger of growing nationalism that we do see, especially now in Eastern Europe. But we may not need those military blocs anymore. I think that's something to look forward to.
Well, I want to talk with you about some of the current changes in the Soviet Union, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Vladimir Posner. He's a Soviet journalist and political observer. He's also a frequent guest on U.S. shows such as Nightline and Donahue. He's written a new autobiography called Parting with Illusions. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Vladimir Posner is my guest. He's a Soviet journalist and political observer. He's also a frequent guest on U.S. programs such as Nightline and Donahue. And he's written an autobiography called Parting with Illusions. The Communist Party recently voted in the Soviet Union to end its monopoly on political power, so there now could be other parties in the Soviet Union. What do you think that's going to mean for life in the immediate future? What kind of parties do you envision coming up as alternatives?
Not only that there could be, as you said, but there will be. There will be many, many parties coming up in Soviet Union. I would suspect that you will have scores of parties to begin with, and they reflect very accurately the situation today, where you have scores of different political groups that are actually just one step away from becoming full-fledged and now legitimate parties. I think it's very good that this has happened. As a member of the party, the Communist Party, I have consistently supported the idea of a multi-party system. I think that for any party to be legitimate, it has to win in an election against other parties. If not, then how can it claim to represent the majority? So I think it's good. I think it'll make the Communist Party a somewhat leaner, if I may use that that word, organization. Not meaner, but definitely leaner. And I think people have to have a choice.
Well, you joined the Communist Party at the age of 33 in 1967. What do you think the chances are that you'll join a new party?
It all depends on what the party platform, the political platform of the Communist Party is going to be. It was supposed to be published on the 8th of February, but when I left Moscow on the 12th of February, it had not yet been published. So as I speak to you now, I don't know what that party platform is. But for a person like myself, a lot depends on that. If I find that the platform is lacking, that I do not agree with it, it may well be that I will think about joining another party, the goals of which, the platform of which, the ideals of which are much closer to what I would like. And today, we do have that alternative choice, which was not true just a few years ago.
How bad are shortages of food and other supplies in the Soviet Union now?
I would say they're very bad in the sense of people being thoroughly frustrated with having to stand in line for just about everything. People are not going hungry in the Soviet Union. We do not have anything close to starvation or even hunger. But people have been willing to sacrifice because they were told that it was for a wonderful cause, and that the day would come when finally they would get their fill. What has happened is that the cause has been thrown in doubt. The people they believed in very often turned out to be criminals. The things they believed in turned out to be lies. And so they say, we've had enough of this. We are sick and tired of being told to wait for a better tomorrow. We want something better now.
Is the Soviet Union in the midst of a depression, of an economic depression?
I don't think the word depression is the correct word. It's in a state of what I would call pre-crisis. We're one step away from an economic crisis, not a depression. And if we do not get our act together this year, in my opinion, 1990, then I believe that there is a real danger of perestroika just going to pieces and the country going to pieces, the consequences of which would be, at least in my opinion, pretty hard to predict.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. Your father was Russian, your mother French, met in Paris, married there, and I think it was during World War II that they actually relocated to the United States.
Yes.
Which is where you grew up,
right.
and where you remained till I think the age of 19.
No. Earlier.
I left.
I left at the tail end of 1948 when I was going on 15.
How did your life in the United States change at the beginning of the Cold War?
Well, see, although my father was a Soviet citizen, he became a Soviet citizen in 1940, I think, or 1941. And although he talked to me a lot about the Soviet Union and about what he thought was a just society, I never considered myself to be Russian. My mother was French, and my first tongue was French. So I thought I was French, but I really lived like the all-American kid from New York City. I lived down in the village. I went to a very nice school. And I felt American, although I knew I wasn't American. But I didn't have any problems ever until, indeed, the very famous speech by Winston Churchill in Fulton, Missouri, when he said that an iron curtain had come down on Europe and the Cold War was on. I was very pro-Soviet. I was very pro everything that the Soviet Union represented, and I was, and I liked to talk, much as I still do. And so, because of my views, I got beat up in school. I started going to Stuyvesant High School, and there I had fights and things like that. My father was fired soon, and we moved out of the beautiful duplex we had in the village, and my parents moved into a very small ground-level apartment on 12th Street. And I went to live with a friend of theirs on Park Avenue. So I didn't go down in life, but it wasn't the same thing. And our friends stopped seeing us and stopped calling us and because the FBI came around to see us and the phones were tapped. And altogether, it became a very difficult time, which I remember very well as being painful.
Why did your family decide to move to the Soviet Union?
Well, my father had wanted to go there for many years. He remembered the revolution of his childhood very romantically, and he felt that the Soviet Union was the just society on earth. And although my father was making very good money in this country, working for Lowe's International, which was a subdivision of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, he wanted to go to the Soviet Union. He wanted to return and take his family with him, that is to say, my mother, my brother, and myself. Now, I don't know whether it would have worked out that way had he not been fired for his very pro-Soviet views and for being a Soviet citizen. Had he not, in fact, been blacklisted and couldn't find a job anywhere, and had he not been refused a visa to France, because my parents decided first to go back to France. My mother was a French citizen. She didn't have a problem. I was inscribed in her passport, as was my brother. But my father was a Soviet citizen, and the French government refused him a visa. So we couldn't go back to France. He didn't want to go to Mexico. He did want to go to the Soviet Union. He didn't have a job. My mother had a nervous breakdown. And suddenly, out of the blue, the Soviet government offered my father a job in East Berlin. And he grabbed it. And that's why we went. So it was a combination of things, both desire and events, pushing us that way.
In your position as a journalist and as someone who's appeared doing political analysis on many American news analysis shows and talk shows, you've defended the Soviet Union over the years. Some people have chosen to see you as an apologist for the Soviet Union. Why? How did you keep your faith in the Soviet Union over the years, witnessing, looking back on its history, for example, Stalin, and then witnessing in contemporary times for you the exile and torture and imprisonment of dissidents, anti-Semitism, censorship of journalists, censorship of free speech, of free expression, of literature. What kept you supporting the Soviet government?
When I defended the Soviet Union on American television, I was talking to people who, in reality, were making political capital out of what they were saying. They didn't care, not deep down inside, not those people. I was not defending the fact that some were sent to psychiatric wards and others to the gulag. I never defended that. But I was defending my country from people who thought that they had something to teach me and to teach us, that they had the right to preach to me, when in fact, I don't feel the United States ever had that right. And in many ways, so I think the United States should look more at itself than preach to any other country, including the Soviet Union.
Do you think of yourself as having very carefully calculated over the years where the line was that you could walk on and maintain your career and your freedom, yet maintain some amount of criticism, but not too much? Because let's face it, if you spoke out too much against the government, you wouldn't have been allowed to speak out much longer.
If you're asking me, did I realize that I was walking a very thin line, the answer is, of course, yes. I realized that very well. And I think that anyone working for improvement in my country but wanting to be able to work, I had to keep that in mind.
Do you feel that when you're on American media that you have to implicitly or explicitly constantly ask the question, why should Americans trust you?
There's no way that I can make them trust me. There is no way that I can say something that will finally sweep away the suspicions that this or that person may have. So I just have to ignore that and say, look, I'm going to do my job. I'm going to do what I think is right. I'm going to say what I want to say. And finally, there will be some kind of judgment. And people will say, yes, he was honest, or no, he was not. And it doesn't matter what I say. Now, there's one particular saying that I like a lot in Russian. And it says, you cannot prove that you're not a camel if someone wants to call you a camel. And so, what do? The KGB mouthpiece or whatever. I have had to ignore those things and just keep on doing what I consider to be right.
Do you ever feel like you have been used in the past as an apologist, or that you've allowed yourself to be that?
Very briefly, we are all used, and I think that we all should realize it. The question is, to what extent do you allow yourself to be used for what you think is a good purpose?
I thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Vladimir Posner, and he has a new autobiography. It's called Parting with Illusions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the largest takeover in Wall Street history, the battle for RJR Nabisco. My guest will be Brian Burroughs, who covered the takeover for the Wall Street Journal and co-authored a new book called Barbarians at the Gate. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dave Edmonds may have grown up in Wales, but what he lived for was American rock and roll. After teaching himself record production, Edmonds has gone on to produce his own records, as well as records by the Fabulous Thunderbirds, K.D. Lang, Dion, and the Everly Brothers. Coming up, we talk with Dave Edmonds. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews 11, the latest album from the Smithereens. The album's been out for a few months, but Ken says it still hasn't gotten the attention or the airplay it deserves. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Revenge. It's the new movie from director Tony Scott, who made Top Gun and Beverly Hills Cop. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The presidents of the U.S., Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia signed an agreement to fight drug trafficking today, one which they say represents a change in the war against drugs. This agreement attempts to focus on economic and trade alternatives instead of just military aid to drug-producing countries. Leslie Werpsa has more on the story.
President George Bush called it the dawn of a new era against drugs. Bolivian President Jaime Paz Zamora described it as a perestroika in the worldwide strategy to fight drug production and consumption. But the Declaration of Cartagena is a package of hopeful generalities with no numbers and few specific pledges. The declaration commits the United States to promote viable domestic and foreign markets for products grown in place of coca leaves. It recognizes the need for increases in trade and private investment to counteract economic upsets that may occur from effective drug control programs. The 12-page statement confuses the issue of military involvement in drug control. It allows each country to use its troops at home, but opens the door for bilateral and multilateral pacts between the armed forces of nations. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Cartagena.
According to reports from Colombia, another American has been kidnapped by guerrillas, the third in less than a week. While President Bush was attending a drug summit meeting in Colombia, an armed group kidnapped a priest in Cali. No group has claimed responsibility for this latest abduction. Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry arrested last month after allegedly smoking crack cocaine in a Washington hotel room, was indicted today on charges of possession of illegal drugs and lying to a federal grand jury. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Barry faces 5 misdemeanor drug possession charges. One stems from the incident last month when he was lured to a hotel room by a female friend and was videotaped by the FBI, allegedly smoking crack. The other 4 counts charge Barry with using cocaine in December 1988 in another Washington hotel, this time with friend Charles Lewis. The mayor faces 3 felony charges for lying to a grand jury in January 1989 about what he knew of Lewis's drug use. Barry is currently in a substance abuse clinic in Florida. No date has been set for his arraignment. If convicted on all counts, the mayor could be sentenced to 20 years in prison and fined up to $1.25 million. This is Brian Naylor at the U.S. District Courthouse in Washington.
Fighting between different Christian groups in Beirut, Lebanon, has resulted in fires in dozens of buildings there. Over 20 people have been killed as families were trapped by the fierce fighting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 25 points to close at 2,649.55 on volume of 174 million shares.
This is Fresh Air. The Smithereens is a New York-based band whose 4 members grew up in New Jersey. 3 of them went to elementary school together. Their first record, a homemade maxi single, was released in 1980. The band's known for their raucous live shows, and they say they wanted to capture a little more of that on their new album. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Remember There's an immensely enjoyable record around just now that I fear will slip into obscurity soon, so I want to call your attention to it. It's called Smithereens 11, but it's only the band's third record, and there are only four Smithereens. Anyway, the album's been around for about 3 months, but the only song attracting even a small amount of radio airplay is A Girl Like You. A Girl Like You is typical Smithereens, a rocking chorus that contrasts nicely with the pure pop melody of the verses. The Smithereens are led by songwriter and singer Pat D'Anizio, who specializes in feeling sorry for himself in a very engaging way.
Blue period, black comedy, such a joke I played on me. I let you go, and now I know. Now I think about the days when I let you down in so many ways. That's the time I want to cry, and the time I wonder why. And pray my apathy is tragedy. I'm content to stay inside. That's the time I can't forget, and it fills me with regret. Always.
The Smithereens are steeped in hard-edged 60s pop, both the classy stuff, like the Beatles and the Kinks, and the agreeably junky stuff, like Paul Revere and the Raiders and Tommy James and the Shondells. Pat D'Anizio takes great care with his lyrics, inserting small puns and rigorous rhyme schemes into his melancholy scenarios. He also tries to break away from the usual rock and roll romance stories. Maria Elena, for example, is a song about Buddy Holly's wife.
Little girl, little one, he gave his heart to you. In this world, you'll never know a love that is more true. I will love you all my days, that's how it's got to be. I believe in true love ways, Maria Elena.
If the Smithereens have a weakness, it's that D'Anizio's voice can be rather monochromatic whenever it doesn't have a first-rate melody to sing. That's true of songs here such as Room Without a View and Blues Before and After. But then D'Anizio can shake off that dolorousness with a song like the vividly detailed William Wilson.
I take my time and I like to move slow. Why should I worry when there's nowhere to go? I like things simple and my friends are all right. I tell no stories and I sleep good at night. Things were different just before I met you. Now I worry, wondering what to do. I was happy never playing your game. Now you tell me that your name is William Wilson.
As I said, Smithereens 11 isn't exactly burning up the charts. In fact, it's pretty much stalled in the low 40s on the latest Billboard pop chart. Why? Well, in a pop world where it took the immensely charming B-52s a full decade to get a top 10 single, who knows? I think part of the Smithereens' problem is that their music is such a clear throwback to an earlier era that radio programmers figure today's listeners will hear it as nostalgia. There's a long line of such contemporary cult acts. Marty Jones, The Feelies, Nick Lowe, The Only Ones, Ian Gom, they all make tuneful, intelligent music that's failed to find a mass audience. But ultimately, there's no reason why the Smithereens shouldn't be enjoying Paula Abdul-sized success.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
I never think about the future, I just live for today. And if you want a ready answer, I've got nothing to say. So please don't bother talking to me, I'll just disappoint you. Because I'm quite content to sit right here with nothing to do.
This is Fresh Air. Welsh-born rocker Dave Edmunds has just released his first studio album under his own name in 5 years. During most of the 80s, Edmunds was busy producing other people, including the Fabulous Thunderbirds, the Stray Cats, and K.D. Lang. He also produced comeback albums for the Everly Brothers and Dion. On March 7th, Edmunds begins a 24-city tour called the Dave Edmunds Rock and Roll Review. It features Dion, Graham Parker, and Kim Wilson of the Fabulous Thunderbirds. Edmunds' career in rock and roll began in England in the late 60s as the singer and guitarist for the group Love Sculpture. In the 70s, he became known for his solo recordings and his playing with bassist Nick Lowe and their group Rock Pile. Edmunds' new record on Capitol is called Closer to the Flame. From the new album, here's King of Love. Stuck really close to the roots of rock and roll?
Not really, I don't think so. I think I've done all kinds of things. I've done a bit of bluegrass and country I've flirted with sometimes, and just out-and-out pop stuff. Although it's, for some reason, people keep saying that all the time, you just stick to the basics of rock, and I don't think I actually do, but it's just that I'm known for that, if anything. Have I blown your question?
No, not at all. I'm interested in what you grew up listening to.
Rock and roll.
Yeah. Well, you grew up in Wales, right? I mean, what was the radio like there?
Oh, there was BBC, and which was, there was nothing at all musical or not popular music of anything. What we used to get was Radio Luxembourg from, it was a European station, used to go all over Europe. And they used to play all the American stuff. That's what everyone used to listen to then.
I remember in the States during the British invasion, everybody would try to sing and sometimes even talk with a British accent because people were so taken with the sound of the British groups. When you were young and in Wales, did you try to sing with an American accent?
I think I still do. It sounds very natural for me to sing with an American accent. Not quite as natural as it seems for Mick Jagger, because he goes a bit over the top with it, doesn't he? But sometimes it seems right, you know, and I don't think about it. It just comes out that way.
Do you ever think that Brits are even more into early rock and roll than a lot of Americans are?
Yes.
Well, what way is that?
I think it had more effect on us. England was like, way back in the 50s, it was like when I was a kid growing up, it was like England was black and white in like a film. You know, it was all very depressing and there wasn't much fun to be witnessed socially. Whereas in America, you had all that stuff and it was reflected in the music. And when kids in England heard that stuff, it was a real breath of fresh air. It had more of an effect because it was we were sharing a culture in a way, and being affected by a different culture, which was seemed like a hell of a lot of fun.
In the mid-70s, you were part of, like, the roots rock movement in England, you know, pub rock and new wave. And I'm thinking of, you know, the work you did on your own and with Rockpile. What did you think of what rock had become by then?
I don't think I've ever sat down to think about what rock has become, especially in the early 70s. I mean, we were into pub rock because we were always all down the pub, you know. That was basically what it was. You went down the pub all the time, and guys like Nick Lowe and all the people I knew, when they weren't out on the road travelling and working, there was pub gigs developed in London where the bands had just set up and played for perhaps less than they normally would go out for, or even more in some cases if they weren't doing too well. And basically it was going down the pub and not thinking about the state of rock and roll. Far from it.
Let me play something that you recorded in the late 70s, mid-70s. This is Trouble Boys, and this is from one of your albums with basically the Rockpile band behind you. Would you say something about this record?
Yeah, it was released as a single in England. It was Billy Bramner's song, and it is Rockpile backing me up.
The Trouble Boys came in. I guess they'd been out fighting and raving. It wasn't long before they moved in and picked up the girls we brought to the dance at the night spot. It goes a tan, so I had to move fast to get my baby back from the Trouble Boys. 25 guys from the east side of the city. Kings of hell racing in the neighborhood. Well, one of them walked up and started dancing with my girl who was crying. Cause I didn't stop him. All I could say to my baby was, honey, this man is bigger than the both of us. He's a Trouble Boy. And his Trouble Boys all around me. No one likes getting sankey in the face. I don't know anyone who stands face to face with a Trouble Boy. Hey,
you started producing records in the 1970s, and I think you basically apprenticed while you had access to a studio in Wales.
Yeah.
How did you get access to the studio? Was it friends of yours who ran it?
Yeah, what it was just about 40 miles from my hometown of Cardiff. There's a little marketing town called Monmouth, and there's two guys that had a band. Their names were Kingsley Ward, Charles and Kingsley Ward, and they set up a little studio in a potato loft. So I just sort of teamed up with them and, in fact, went to live in the area and started using the studio and learning how to make records. I had this thing about I wanted to play all the instruments myself. I don't know why. Just to have control over it all, I suppose. And that was the perfect way to do it without any pressure of, like, booking studio time and all that. I just sort of... It was like sort of coming in the back door of the recording industry. Which I found a very comfortable way of doing it, and I learned to produce my own records.
I think you learned to produce in different styles. For instance, you did your own versions of some of Phil Spector's classic records. You did a version, for instance, of Baby, I Love You, and you did all the parts. You did all the instruments, all the voices.
That was just as a hobby, you know. I never used to make records with a view to releasing them. It was just in the same way as... kids around now, they'll buy a little four-track cassette recorder, and in their bedroom they got a little mixer and they just have fun in it. And that's what I was doing, but in a real studio, although not a very advanced studio. But it was everything I did was just for the fun of it, just for the hell of it. And somewhere along the line, then later, it got released.
Although you're no longer remaking Spector records, I think now you've got the production techniques at your fingertips. And for instance, on the new record by Dion that you produced, there's one track, Always in the Rain, that sounds like you're really using some
Spector-inspired
techniques.
That's right. I just called up all my old tricks,
there,
really. I just dialed them up, and I thought, right, what did I used to do? And it was very easy. That came together very quickly, and it was a lot of fun.
You
Have you ever been produced by someone who you felt had you all wrong in the final mix or in the final production style?
No, I've never been produced by anyone, really. Except with Jeff Lynne, but that was different. I mean, he wrote the song and he had it all in his head, so I was just doing the singing and playing the guitar. So, no, I've never been produced by anyone. It'd be awful. I'm quite opinionated in the studio, and I think unless it was the right person I'm working with, I'd clash with them.
Do you think it's a blessing to be able to produce yourself? Have you met a lot of performers who feel like their sound isn't the sound they wanted because they were with a producer who got it wrong?
Yeah, I don't know the whole thing about producers. What do they do? I don't know what a producer does. It can be anything from making the tea to completely to doing a Jeff Lynne and writing the song and writing the record, you know, the whole thing. It can be anything in between. And it is very difficult. It's a role. It's not a well-defined role.
Well, where on that scale do you fit?
I like to get with a band and feel that there's something that I can obviously contribute towards making a good record. Where they might be good at certain things, but in the studio they don't quite know how to get it down onto tape and things like that. I can't just go in cold and hope that I'm going to come up with something. I have to feel, yeah, there's definitely something I can contribute to this project, mm-hmm. and I would hate for anyone else to get the job. You know, that sort of thing.
Let's go out with something from your new record. How about Every Time I See Her?
That sounds good to me.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Words fill out on an empty page. Every time I see her, my friends say better at your age. Every time I see her, I don't care if it seems I've lost my mind. Is it just imagination or does something crazy happen every time? I wanna hold her but I lose my grip. Every time I see her,
Dave Edmunds' new album, Closer to the Flame, is on Capitol Records. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. A report from President Bush's day at the Drug Summit in Cartagena, Colombia. Also, NPR's John Madison talks with Nelson Mandela in South Africa. We'll have letters from listeners about French teaching and other matters, and a review of the current state of the debate on Social Security funding up on Capitol Hill. Also, microwave foods for kids and low-fat microwave cooking, a new cookbook, and the success story of a group called Banana Kelly. It's a community group, now 12 years old, involved over those years in reclaiming abandoned homes in the South Bronx and doing very well indeed.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tony Scott has directed the hit films Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop, and Beverly Hills Cop 2. His new movie, Revenge, stars Kevin Costner. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
If you thought Revenge would turn out to be a movie about, say, revenge, then you're not thinking like a top professional motion picture director. Take, for instance, Tony Scott. By now, he's one of the most successful movie directors in history. Before that, he was heavily in demand as a director of commercials back in his native England. And you can see where he'd be good at that. Revenge, for instance, isn't about revenge. It's about, well, the main thing it's about is the drapes. When you see drapes in this movie, or curtains, or gauzy sheets, well, try to notice if they're billowing or not. See, if they're billowing, that means danger. Get it? It's symbolism. Now, follow along here. Revenge isn't about revenge. It's about phallic beer bottles. And the phallic beer bottles represent, you know, male bonding. You with me? Okay. Revenge isn't about revenge. It's about shafts of light, and the shafts of light represent hope. Unfortunately, I'm talking about the hope the characters feel, not the hope the viewer might feel, because the viewer would best be advised to abandon said hope upon entering the portals of that luckless cineplex where revenge is taking its toll. The story here concerns an ace pilot, Cochran, played by Kevin Costner. He quits the Air Force to sort of, you know, find himself, and the first thing he does is head down to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, to visit his old pal Mendez, played by Anthony Quinn. Now, Mendez is one of those powerful and ruthless Mexican land barons who like to hunt and casually kill their political adversaries and marry beautiful women a third their age. And in this case, the woman in question is Miria, played by Madeline Stowe. She and Cochran meet as Cochran is driving his Jeep in search of Mendez's house, and Miria is walking her horse down the same road.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm a little lost. I was wondering if... Is everything all right?
Yes, he just threw a shoe.
Well, maybe you can help me. I'm trying to find the Mendez place.
Mr. Cochran?
Yes. Mrs.
Mendez.
I must be warm.
You are. It's the first gate on the left.
Thank you.
You can tell from the searing tension in that scene, not to mention, of course, the urbane wit, that Cochran and Miria will soon have an affair, and that Mendez and his henchmen will have to punish them cruelly, and that Cochran will survive in order to find and save Miria and confront Anthony Quinn. Or maybe you can't tell, but now you know. The story has more than a driblet of Hemingway in it. It's about men's men and what honorable behavior is and what happens when honorable behavior is breached. And maybe there could have been a movie here, if anyone involved in the project had wanted to explore those subjects. But what Scott wants to explore is those drapes and shafts of buttery light. And so this putatively tough thriller turns into the world's lengthiest perfume commercial and gets cornier and more aimless as it goes along. Costner is a bit stiff, as always. And Anthony Quinn is ebullient and sexy, and Madeline Stowe is a very dull actress, though her good looks are unconventional enough to keep your eyes busy when nothing else does. But really, in the end, you don't even need to know these things. All you need to know is that if Revenge is playing at Cinema 1, what you want is Cinema 2.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show this week was produced by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Dan Laughlin, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Drexel Burnham Lambert just became the largest investment firm ever to file for bankruptcy. It wasn't long ago they financed the largest corporate takeover in history. On the next Fresh Air, background and analysis from Brian Burrow, co-author of Barbarians at the Gate. Also, we meet Spike Lee cinematographer Ernest Dickerson. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.